Blog Talk Radio.
Excited. I am by myself today. This is Owen McIntyre. Eric Burke has left me to die. He has gone to Jamaica and totally left me in charge of everything. I now have in front of me all the funny little buttons that he gets to push. So I've been dying to do this. Just give me 1 second.
You underestimate the power of the dark side.
Yes. Anyway, we have a good episode on for everybody tonight. We have Rob Stone and Scott Broden on. They're going to come. They're going to talk snakes with me. We're going to talk about breeding seasons. We're going to talk about tricks of the trade. We're also going to talk about the snake market and what's going on with the reptiles that we all know and love throughout the wonderful little hobby. If it goes badly, I will change the name to the Royal Python Radio, and Eric will never, ever need to know about this. So anyways, let's just click on Scott and Rob. Hold on 1 sec. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Good. Excellent. And for some reason, there's somebody already calling. But anyway, why don't we go ahead and get into the normal stuff. Scott, why don't you give us a little bit, tell us a little bit about yourself, as well as what you're working with, and then Rob, why don't you do the same?
Well, first off, did you really put a dark side thing on before I came on?
I can't help it. I can't find all the buttons yet. All right?
Oh,
so that was
shit.
Just the first one I found. I'm working on it. So, like, I got this one.
On. Guess what? I got a fever, and the only prescription is more cowbell.
He's going to hate me, okay, because this is going to be the worst episode. I'm going to be pushing buttons all day. But it gets for leaving me. Anyway.
I've pretty much been keeping mostly snakes for 15 years. Pretty much my uncle influenced that. Probably my first reptile show. Jesus Christ, I don't even know how old I was. And then I actually got my first snake by winning a bet with my parents to do better in school. And then... I kind of snowballed a little bit for 15 years. And then I kept, I don't even know. I used to keep a lot of just different shit. I think I spent a decade not even caring about breeding. Carpets. Carpets, actually, have always been there for 12 years, 13 years, something like that. And also always had a thing for the shit that little less people work with, and like white-lip pythons, things of that nature. Actually, a white-lip was my fourth snake. worst fourth snake you can get after working with snakes for 3 years, but
that is the truth.
Especially when it's a 7-foot female that was
wild
caught, that was absolutely insane.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where you have to put it in the closet in its cage so it doesn't see you type of deal. And it only ate birds. That was fun.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Yeah, I don't like that.
I switched her to fucking rats. I switched her. I got rid of her because I couldn't handle her at that point, man. She was super aggressive. But, these days, as most people know, I work with mostly jungles. I got the Sabus, the White Lips, all that fun shit.
Mm-hmm. Now, Rob, can you hang on 1 second? Because we do have a caller, and they, let's see who this is. If this is bad, hello, you're on the air. Hello. Who is this? And they're gone. All right. Yes. I'm off to a great start. Anyway, so, Rob, why don't you just remind the people who you are, because you have been on the show before. So what's going on?
No, not too much, man. An auspicious beginning for sure. As you say, a couple times, I don't know, you know, been through most of this stuff, you know, the usual things, you know, had my experience, snakes getting out on the plane, inspiring the movie and all, so that was good.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, yeah, you know, I mean, at this point, kind of varied interests. I mean, I think that's, you know, a big thing. We can all appreciate different, you know, basically everything, right? But that doesn't mean you want to keep it in your house. And so at this point, I've been shellfish, rhino rat snakes, Homahara, scrub pythons. I'm buying a few chondros lately. They're pretty cool. Watching change and stuff. Let's see. Got some cocci. A lot of variable king snake. About 35 of those things. And some womas. Pretty much the story. And the leopard gecko that just eats a bunch of stuff and it's pretty cool.
See, yeah, you did the since we had that one episode with you, I have been looking at rhino rat snakes, so if I do get a pair, I fully blame you for that one. I mean, that's all you. I mean, that's...
Well, they're the hardiest snakes I've ever seen, dude, to be honest with you, out of the, you know,
they're cool looking. I mean, you know...
Snakes, species that I've had, they are. You could put them in... Your setup, I know, you know, with your conditions that, you know, we've talked about, I've heard, you can pop them in there with no extra heat. I keep them here with, you know, ambience now in the 60s, and they do fine there, too. I mean, they're bulletproof, too.
Awesome. I mean, you're running by stuff that you think would be cool to work with and would also be kind of cool to see on your table and stuff like that, and then rhino rats, I keep coming back to that because... Colubrids are a big thing, and, you know, you always want to kind of get something that's a little bit cooler. Anyway, with that one, let's kind of lead right into the stuff. What do you guys think about the growth of the market? I mean, I'm sitting here, and I see more and more and more that the reptiles are becoming, I don't know if I want to say popular, definitely more mainstream and visual. People who have pet snakes are taking pictures of snakes. People who are not really into snakes still are kind of checking them out and the kind of cool stuff. So I definitely see that the market has kind of grown a little bit. What do you guys think? Rob, why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot to that. I mean, obviously, as you guys have touched on repeatedly, I think the, you know, loss of Steve Irwin has been a crusher, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really,
mm-hmm.
That's when we stopped seeing reptiles positively on television. But you know, that being said, I think a lot of people who were exposed to that sort of material kind of before we turned into Animal Planet hunting the Yeti and stuff.
I hate that.
You know, I think that generation of folks, right, which includes us, I would think, you know, we're on the, I would say, on the front end of that curve, you know, definitely feeling... You know, feeling it in the market, and I see all these folks. You know, yeah, heck, I saw it today. Someone who I, you know, have no exposure to, don't know in any way, shape, or form, seems like a ball python person, you know, liked my Facebook page out of nowhere. I, you know, haven't posted in a couple weeks, whatever. I have no idea how she found it, whatever, but, you know, that's a positive sign for sure, saying, hey, here's a random person that just, you know, popped on and, heck, had saw something of interest, even though it's not, you know, ball python. So that's great, I think.
That is good. I mean, it's the people are always talking about battle lines that are being drawn between all the reptile people. It's like I'm a carpet python person, and that's all I will do, and your ticks suck. So it's definitely good that people are kind of branching out and jumping into stuff, and so I could definitely see that. Scott, what do you think?
I completely agree. I know that I go to the reptile shows now, there's definitely a good mix of people. New people, obviously people that have been doing it, you know, like me, has gone to stupid shows for 15 years. But the last one, I know when I go to Hudson Valley, usually I go to White Plains, I just go and talk to Mike and Jason and all them, so I don't really pay attention. But I know the local show in the Poughkeepsie, it's definitely gotten better. I was actually impressed. They just started it back up like 2 years ago when I got back into the hobby a little more. I kind of backed out a little bit. Still kept carpets and all that, but I slowed down. And I, you know, when I got back, I said, Poughkeepsie's 10 minutes. Let me go up there. And I was actually amazed at the amount of people there. And a lot of, you know, young kids and newer people and checking it out and all. You could hear the not whispers, we could overhear conversations about this and that. And I was like, oh, that's good. I'm glad to see that. So, and plus, you know, obviously Facebook has just done wonders for either exposing new people or spreading more rare stuff, trying to expose that kind of stuff to, you know, ball python keepers, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good sign. So now we've all been at the shows, and we definitely see that the certain animals kind of carry through. There's always going to be a good amount of animals of a certain type, i.e. years ago used to be tons of boa constrictor. Now it's a ton of ball python. Do you guys see any kind of a shift in what species are presented at a show? Or is it still the same old, same old? Scott?
Seriously? Have you been to a show lately?
I'm hopeful, damn it!
Really? Oh, man. You know, I got to be honest. I would love to see a shift more towards less ball pythons like everybody else. I've had multiple friends who have kind of are newer in a hobby or just gotten back into it. And you guys know how it is. You go to a show, I mean, it's mostly ball pythons. They just started having a show up in Albany because I'm in New York, and I didn't make that one. From what I heard, it wasn't bad. So to my understanding, the promoters of that are trying to, you know, have a little more diversity. And I mean, Owen, you're coming to Poughkeepsie. It's the same promoters. I mean, for instance, Poughkeepsie, you take that show, you'll be the only legitimate carpet guy there. That's for sure. You might see some of Viking's old stock there, maybe, but I don't think so, because he used to come up to that show, but you know he's out of it. So I don't know if the guy who has that stuff is still coming to Poughkeepsie or not. But, yeah, I would like to say that maybe, you know, soon we'll see a shift towards something else, but at the moment, it's all ball pythons still, unfortunately.
Kind of seems the way it goes. Rob, how about the shows out by you? Do you vend shows, Rob, or?
Yeah, there's two different shows here in Colorado. One is, what, four times a year, and the other is twice a year. And those, you know, the two shows end up being roughly kind of the same in terms of, you know, spring and fall. And then there's one actually coming up here. The one that's four times a year is just over 3 months, including one, what, the second weekend of this coming month of February. So, I usually share a table with folks and just kind of bring out some stuff. Mostly, you know, how it is, you go and talk to people and whatever. Most of the stuff that I have at this point in time, I end up, you know, keeping myself, or it's already, you know, pre-spoken for or whatever. And I think, really, to your point, a lot of people have an interest in the stuff that I bring, whether it's, you know, a $200 snake or rhinos that sell every day for $750 a pair. You know, you can sell as many as you got. But I think up until recently, the thing that really moves it, that there's interest in everything, but the thing that moves, you know, typically is the cheaper stuff, right? The leopard geckos, some of the, you know, less expensive corn snakes, that sort of stuff. But, and the only money I've seen spent on at these local shows really is the ball python stuff. But I would say that that seems to be changing. Not so much that there's more diversity there now. It's just that, honestly, man, I see these people with ball pythons, and even the other people with ball pythons don't stop.
Yes.
That's the funny thing. Like, you know, it's just, like, no interest whatsoever. And I think if you're at the more forward-looking shows, like the San Diego Super Show or in Pomona, which just happened, or Tinley, I think you're going to see there, I know from this past Pomona, I didn't go, but all reports say there actually weren't all that many ball pythons. There was a lot of, and I think the West Coast is a little bit always that way, but yeah, like, I think those more forward-looking shows were kind of moving past that just because, heck, dude, even, as I say, I see it here, even the people who keep ball pythons aren't stopping at these ball python tables. And I see guys who got into it, you know, kind of with the dollar signs in the last couple of years, and they have their table, and they've spent all of this money on their sets, and literally no one's stopping, and they're not selling a single snake. And,
jeez.
You know, it's, I laugh because, well, I'm glad you had an interest, but I think you made some poor decisions, and hopefully, rather than getting out of it, you'll be redirected into something. You'll say, hey, even the crested gecko dude gets a ton more interest than I do, and seems to be having more fun. You know, I mean, it doesn't have to be, you know, we hit on this very briefly earlier, but it doesn't have to be obscure stuff to be cool, man. You can like whatever you want to like. I just, the thing that bums me out about the ball python thing is I don't think the people keeping ball pythons really like them, at least some percentage. It's just like, oh, it's a cool paint job. They look really sweet as babies, some of them. And then they're just kind of, you know, bumps on a log that don't eat, which I hate, and, you know, don't do anything. And, I mean, part of the reason, right, I think that a lot of people end up having huge collections of ball pythons is they are somewhat inconsistent in terms of getting females that get up to size so that, oh, you know, the whole reason you bought that ball python is so that when it turns 3 and then 4 and then 5 in terms of a female, you know, it'll produce eggs. And that one day a year when they hatch out, it's going to be awesome, right? And you're going to make new stuff and it'll be very cool. That's like the whole payoff. Dude, if your female stops eating at 1,200 grams, you can't get her up to size for 4, 5, 6 years. Like, now that this whole thing is just very frustrating. And I think, unfortunately, we will lose people from the industry just because it'll be so negative, right? I mean, there's, if you have 5 snakes, there's nothing more frustrating than, especially if you're feeding live, than tossing it in and having it have no interest whatsoever, right? Now you have to back off. Like, I mean, I see, you know, that's the big lie to my mind, and I don't mind phrasing it that way, about the ball python thing. They're not a great starter or pet snake because dude, that's like the number one thing, you know, hardiness and eat. Those are like the two main requirements for like a first pet snake. And those things are not good, you know, really.
No.
I would argue it either, but certainly it's feeding. So, you know, I think people are seeing that, and I think there is a movement away. And heck, dude, I, you know, everything's cyclical. We see this all the time. There's been, you know, at these local shows, too, no one has leopard geckos even. And it's like, if the folks who do, even in limited numbers or whatever, they're second selling the heck out of them, you know? And
I think
that's okay. You know, I think everything comes and goes, and stuff like that that is a good choice, you know, will routinely come back. And I think that's a great spot for people to hop in. I just feel like it's got to be about enjoyment of the animal, and it's got to be a good fit, not just, hey, everyone wants ball fight. No, they don't.
Sorry,
they don't. Like,
so,
what are you going to do with your pinstripe ball web? Nothing. You're going to put it on Craigslist, and it's going to be a shabackle.
Oh, my God. That would kill me. But it's like, I totally get what you're saying with that, and it has definitely been that kind of a way now where I see a lot of people going down the aisles, and I've always said that if somebody isn't interested in what's on your table, they're not going to stop. They're going to look at it and be like, oh, scale things, and then move on to the next table. And it's always good to have the hook to get them to look at it a little bit closer, because then they will probably like what you got going on. So I totally get what you're saying, Rob, where people are coming down the aisles now at these shows in Hamburg, and I see them, they just go. They just blaze right past all the tables. There's a lot of looking, and definitely what you're saying about that the shows now seem to be a lot geared towards, I'm coming in with $100, how many reptiles can I walk out the door with my $100? Yeah. And I would like to keep 50 of it. So I'm going to negotiate with everybody that I would like this for $10. And it's gotten to be that point now where it is the quick sales, the small things are always the ones that are going at reptile shows. And if something is a big purchase, I know you're coming beforehand, and I know you're coming to get it. That used to be carpet pythons that are up in the $700-$800 range. Now, I know you're coming if it's a $200 carpet python. It's one of those things where it used to be the mid stuff would go at the show too, maybe to one or two people. So it shows have been awfully disappointing for me this year. Do you guys think that there's merit in possibly not doing shows and sticking more to an online business basis if you do higher-end animals?
Right. Well, dude, I've always respected the hell out of you for doing as many shows as you do. You know, and I think that's tough sledding, dude. You know what I mean? Like, I like going and I like not having a table so I can just talk to my friends and stuff, you know. And frankly, in terms of the vendors and stuff, I know all the people here. And, you know, if anyone's going to buy anything from me at the show, it's probably going to be one of them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's going to be, I either A, knew beforehand or I can, you know, pull out this bag of snakes. And
before
like,
the doors open, right.
Right, you know what I mean? And not even for them to resell it, just, you know, for this, because they want it, you know, and it's something they've been looking at for a long time. And I think there's a lot of merit to that. And I think, you know, if you're selling animals that are more than, honestly, I would say the mid $100, you know, 150 or so, I would guess that it's kind of tough sledding, you know. And I just think, you know, Eric should do Tinley, and hopefully I cast if that happens again. I mean, we all know the story, you know, the story there. But, you know, those things are different. I would definitely, you know, I'm sad I missed that one, and I really hope, you know, that it gets put back together again. Maybe, oh, dude, maybe it should be here, or maybe it should be in Florida, or maybe, you know, probably not Florida with all their laws, but, you know. like, maybe up at Terry's place once again, you know, back into that. I know that that's its own political, you know, beehive or whatever, but something like that, you know, where it's just, you know, that's the sort of thing where, I mean, heck, dude, and I even did that back in the day with, you know, when I was reselling all those animals from Cameron, kind of handpicked, saying, I'm not just dealing crap, you know, this isn't flipper stuff, this is flipper for the collector, right? You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, it's not flipping stuff when you're saying, dude, I picked the best two out of the 100 he got. I saw the 100. I picked two. These are the ones you should go with. That's kind of the different thing. And I feel like, you know, that was kind of the model for the business at that point in time. And frankly, I think that's the model we should all be going for now, because you're, you know, in a quality versus quantity situation. And really, I think that's best for everyone, you know, including the animals.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. It's more of like the take pride in your animals and make sure you can be picky. Scott, what do you think? I mean, I know you're kind of gearing up. Would you do shows, or are you just going to sell online with your stuff?
You know, I've played that question in my head a few times. I don't know. I might do the local show here in Poughkeepsie. I might not in Albany. I mean, you know, I talked to some of the guys, and I know someone who has issues with shows, with mites and that. And again, I mean, I don't plan on doing a shitload of clutches. So I started gearing back up and getting carpets and all that. I had all these, you know, visions in my head. I'm like, oh, fuck, I'm going to have, you know, this pair, this pair, this pair, this pair. And, you know, all the other shit that I like working with, the rarer stuff and all that. But as time's going on, I'm kind of, like, focusing on jungles, just do quality jungles, you know, white-lipped sabus. I've got a couple other little things I want to try to get
I have scrub coming soon, but that's not actually going to even be for breeding. That's just going to be for a fun pet.
I approve of that.
Anyone should approve of a scrub. Come on now.
Everyone should approve of a scrub.
I'm pretty excited for that. Yeah, that's coming from White
Plains.
Yeah. That'll be badass. But that's just a pet. I mean, you know, you say it now, but who knows what will happen down the road.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I really don't know. I mean, the numbers I plan on doing, even when I get going, as far as jungles, I mean, the other stuff is harder to breed. I mean, we were talking about it before the show. White lips are a pain in the freaking ass.
Dear Lord.
That takes, like, 27 years to reach maturity. So, you know, I just have the Sabus, like, hey, if I breed them one day, that'll be an accomplishment. But otherwise, they're just freaking awesome to have. So I don't plan on doing a huge number where I'm going to be like, you know, I really got to do shows. If I do, it'll be local show, and, you know, we'll play it by ear. But, so, maybe a couple of year, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, I've said it a few times where if the one show that's local to me were a mile further, I would say screw it, because I never do well at that show, and it's always a very bad thing, and I always feel like covering myself in, you know, Preventamite when I come home. So it's one of those things. And the main thing I'm seeing is that a lot of people are opting for the do the big shows but sell online, like spend the money to go out to Tinley Park, Daytona, whatever the big show is, but and then don't do any other shows and sell online. I mean, I think that kind of seems to be the business model that a lot of people are kind of shifting towards, because it's kind of put your product in front of the people who want to look at it. So would that be an option for either one of you guys? Have you thought about it?
As far as vending Tinley Park, man, I'm just trying to get out there.
Yeah, I haven't even been there either, so I have no room to talk.
Go, man, you know. I'm going to try and go in October, that's for sure. I agree. I think you're right. Put stuff. If you have the opportunity to vend a show like that, or, you know, one of the super shows or something, and obviously I think you should do it. Couldn't hurt.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I used to vend at Daytona, and certainly that was always, you know, fun and exciting, and, you know, certainly there was more, you know, you'd have guys who would come over from Japan and say, hey, can I buy some of those rhinos, you know, and I'd say, okay, they're not sighties, so it was relatively easier, but they're, you know, I don't have any paper, there isn't paperwork to have, but I certainly don't have any, and they're saying, oh, well, can you just sign this receipt, or and I'm like, sure, I don't think it's going to get you much, but I don't mind, dude. Whatever, that's cool with me.
Jesus.
You know, that's, I don't get that at my local show. And that's humorous. And, I mean, heck, dude, some of the animals you see there, I mean, Damon lizards were there, you know, back in, what, 03 or 04, when we just hadn't seen them for years. You see all these frogs that are, it's like, oh, that's a Brazilian native species, and they look, you know, they're all half dead, and no one's ever bred these things. Like, you better hop on that train while you can. And, you know, it's not a surprise that, you know, Bob Mayu was at the table buying frogs. You know what I mean? Like, sweet dude, good call, because you're going to produce those frogs, and that's great. That stuff certainly doesn't happen at my local show. There is one guy who, Andy Watson, who breeds all these crazy little geckos and stuff, and I respect the hell out of it. I mean, he brings these tenopus geckos and all this stuff, and I don't think there's really any market for it here, but, you know, he fights a good fight and brings it every time, and he does bring some stuff, Racketaclis and stuff that sells, and he splits tables with guys and whatever, so it's not a bad deal, but that's always amazing. You know, I'm saying this is the sort of table that would fit in perfectly at one of those big shows. I mean, if he had that same table at the Super Show or at Tinley, man, he would sell a lot of geckos. People would say, holy shit, I got to get me some of these South African geckos and whatever. You know, but here it's kind of like, wow, that's a wacky-looking gecko. And he's like, yeah, that's a $2,000 gecko.
And then you put it down gently, yeah.
It's like, oh, okay, that's pretty cool, dude. I think it's great, and if you can afford to go, I'd love to hear, what was your experience as a vendor, not just kind of in terms of, you know, having some beers and having a good time at the ICAST? Like, how did that go for you? Like in terms of
ICAST?
Some snakes and stuff, yeah.
Well, ICAST was good because ICAST was of it was lectures and tickling the inner herp nerd the whole weekend, which was great. And, of course, I'm wandering around down there, and I'm sitting up, and, you know, I look up, and Eugene Bissette is, like, poking at one of my scrub pythons. So I'm like, okay, all right, well, I'm going to let him do that because I don't feel I have the right to tell him not to. So I don't think I'm important enough to tell him to stop. So it was one of those things. And then the show was there constantly, but people weren't actually shopping or doing anything until the last day. So I was like, I set up all these animals and I skipped Hamburg and then nothing happened until Sunday, but I'm glad I did it. And I definitely had a ton of fun. It was this big room, and it was a semicircle of these insane-looking animals from corner to corner. It was intense. You'd start at one end, you start walking, and you just see chondro after chondro after chondro after chondro of insane color, insane body. It was just, they were just amazing animals. And then you reached over, there were somebody, some bastard put rough-scale pythons right next to my table. So all I could do was stare at them and go, you don't have the money, Owen, stop it. So, and then, of course, it was mine and Eric's table where Eric brought every single type of carpet python known to human being to put up there to show off. I brought a bunch of my scrubs. I brought my white lips. And then you keep going around the room, and it was a bunch of fun just walking around because it was basically imagine going into a store and it being stocked with nothing but what you want to see. What you enjoy.
Without ball
exactly. There was nothing in there except what I found interesting. What I would have enjoyed more, though, is if some of the other vendors from some of the other species were to get in there. Like if there had been arboreal geckos, if there had been arboreal monitors, tree monitors, things like that. If there had been a bunch of stuff like that, I was going to try to bring a mangrove monitor baby with me. But they were all tied up back in Pennsylvania. So it would have been cool to have some of those games. I know there are also some of the arboreal venomous species. I know there were some eyelash vipers, but I know there are a bunch more. It was a great start. It was a wonderful stepstone. I'm excited to see where it goes from here. I would love for it to be, you know, you walk around the room and this is the python section, then you move on to the arboreal venomous, then you move on to the arboreal monitors and geckos and frogs. It is extreme room to grow, and it was a ton of fun. I did steal the ice bucket.
More shit that it says I need to get it because that's why
I know it was terrible.
It's your fault that I have a scrub python coming in.
It is not my fault you have a scrub python. It is Hazel's fault that you have a scrub python. I still get tagged in photos of people who I don't even know who they are and when they were holding her, but that's her with them in ICAST because that snake went around the room like 20 times. And I'm pretty sure I was going to have to like pry her away from Mark Spataro because he wanted her. So it was a very good show. I did steal my ice bucket from my hotel room, and I was drinking rum and Cokes most of the day Saturday. Which is obvious if you listen to the show that we did at ICAST. Yes. So Eric should have watched me better. That is, again, his fault. But ICAST was glorious. Even arboreal tarantulas. If you're going to do it. I think that'd be great. So I'm excited for the next one. I hope to God they do another one. So anyways, we have the callers back. I don't know if I should click on again. I want to see. What? Yeah, let's do this. If this is Eric checking up on me from Jamaica, I'm going to beat him. All right. Hold on. Hello, you're on the air. And they're calling again. All right, that's it. You're done. No more calling. So,
what's the area code?
215, which is my area code, which is confusing. Mm-hmm. Anyways, let's get back to what we were talking about. So when you guys look at this stuff, the popularity of the snakes, do you see kind of popularity going in a direction that it ought not to be? I don't know if either of you guys saw, but recently somebody messages me on Facebook and says, I would like a venomous snake. And I say, and I quote, I don't have any venomous. Sorry. And he goes, well, do you know anybody who has a viper or a cobra, something big that can be handled? And when I hear the word can be handled, the little zookeeper in my brain starts, like, screaming because it's like, no, no, don't touch it. So I ask him, like, well, handling, what do you mean? Do you have venomous experience? And he says, no, but I watch a lot of TV and I read a lot of books and I got to learn somewhere. And I went off on this poor, I assume, teenager and is like, you should never own a venomous until you have proper training. Do you have any of that stuff? Go away before you die. Have you guys seen any kind of popularity towards animals that you don't think should be really owned until you get into it? Like, if you're seeing any beginners, go right for the croc monitors and the venomous snakes right off the bat.
Oh, boy. I don't. Oh, man, I don't know. I saw a lot of that years ago.
Yeah.
A little more so. I still see it now. None of that shit's legal in New York. You know, every once in a while, I'll get a message from someone, and I can usually tell pretty quickly where they're going with stuff. I had one recently message me, and he starts talking about retics and this and that, and because I had my profile picture of me with a reticulated python, that's my friend, that has all that, and, you know, I knew right away where he was going with it, and I tried to tell him, like, you know, I know what you're doing. I mean, I'm not someone who's going to say anything about it, but, you know, I don't know if you should be working with certain stuff, but I think it's not, the problem is that the people, I commented on your picture, and I said, I'll guarantee it, he'll get it from somebody.
Oh, he will. I imagine that'll happen.
The problem is, if someone's got, like you said, if someone's got experience, then that's fine, but it just takes that one freaking idiot who gets fucking tagged, and boom, it's news now, everywhere. So that's the problem, the guy like that, they called you, and I'm sure there's a ton of those guys, you know, getting rattlesnake, cobras, whatever. I mean, you know how easy it is to get that stuff.
It is. I mean, my friend Chris bought a pair of white-lipped tree vipers at the age of 16 at Hamburg, just walked in, bought them, walked out. I've seen a 15-year-old in front of me buy a Nile crocodile off a table next to me. I almost want to say that some of these things should be regulated, but the second I say that, all the herper friends start throwing rocks at me. So yeah. I really can't say too much, but I mean, Scott, have you been offered animals that would be illegal where you live?
Now?
Yeah.
Now or years ago? Years ago, I saw a lot more of it.
Let's say now. Let's say, like, have you been approached by anybody since the rules in New York have gone through about taking animals that are completely, you know, they are illegal, you know this person shouldn't even have it in New York, and they're trying to pawn it off on you?
No, not so much. And I think the reason is because, you just kind of look at my pictures and stuff, it's pretty obvious that I work with carpets and all that. I get offered carpets, like, quite a bit. You know, I was hanging out at the show. Poughkeepsie at my friend's table, and I've had two or three people come up to me with just random, you know, mixed match coastals from God knows where that are probably full of mites, and I'm like, you know, I'm like, sorry, you know, I'm very meticulous about my room. I try not to bring in, you know, too much outside stuff that, other than stuff from people I know. So, but, you know, I really can't say I've been offered anything in a while. I mean, years ago, I was around it a lot more. I knew a lot more people that were involved in that kind of stuff. But, you know, I moved. A lot of those people aren't even doing it anymore. I actually saw a friend of mine who did do a lot of shady stuff years ago. And I actually asked him, I said, you know, what are you doing now? And he's not even doing that kind of stuff anymore. And I think the difference is now, too, is, like I said, one accident happens, all of a sudden the media gets a hold of it and it goes insane. So I don't get anyone offering me stuff for me to take.
I do get people once in a while that'll talk to me, and I can read between the lines and know what they're, what they have or stuff like that. You know, when someone asks you where they can get, you know, very large rabbits, I've had that multiple times, and I'm like, well, what do you got? And they're like, oh, I don't really want to say. I'm like, dude, I don't give a shit. Just freaking tell me. I know. It's either a berm or a retic or something like that. So, you know, it's more that. Not so much the hops, although I'm sure it still goes on. But
probably. I think I can assume. Rob, have you seen anybody kind of jumping in 2 feet in the wrong end of the pool, per se?
Well, I mean, heck, dude, right? We've all bought some benefits in the past, because, I mean, how else are you going to effectuate the old rattlesnake in the mailbox trick, you know? I mean, I've done that before. Yeah.
Never done that one.
But, no, I mean, seriously, I think, sure, but benefits are illegal here in Colorado as well. There is a permit system, but it's always projected as the sort of permit that you don't really get, and even the one person I know that did have one, I think, was not renewed, you know, for no clear reason, just kind of they don't want to issue those permits. I think there is some limited scale keeping, certainly. There was a large scale bust that I think was really more about, you know, pot and gun. Back up, what would that be? Have to be about 10 years ago or more now at this point, some 10 or 11 years ago. And I think, you know, there was a lot of pretty crazy hot stuff. And I think that was probably the biggest collection of venomous stuff in the state. And, I mean, cool animals for sure. But, yeah, I mean, heck, dude, I just don't think there's, I mean, even the coolest venomous, right, if you click through there and you're looking at Crutchfield stuff or whatever, like, you know, you see some stuff where they're trying to put it up for big money, but really all that venomous stuff is, you know, there's a limited price point because your market's so limited. There's really not that much interest. And even amongst the folks who are interested, you know, those folks aren't necessarily the ones with, you know, a bunch of money to throw around. And a lot of the time they're going to look at it as, you know, a pet. Even if it's something they, you know, they'll pick up as a project to try and breed or whatever, they're not looking at it saying, oh, I'm going to make $1 million. Most of them have a pretty solid sense of, this is a cool animal and I might reproduce it. And there will be some interest, but it's not going to be interest at, you know, thousands of dollars. And, you know, I think most of them get that. I mean, heck, what Chris was even saying, he had to sell those water cobras for 75, or forest cobras or whatever, for $75. I mean,
he had to bail out of those things.
You know,
because
there's no market for it. You know, they're cool snakes. They're neat. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't keep them in my basement for sure, but, you know, that doesn't mean they're not really awesome animals. It's just there's no market for it, you know, basically, except in kind of the real exceptional species that, you know, arguably are more manageable. You know, some of the little montane rock rattlesnakes and stuff that are really badass. You know, that's one thing. There's, I think, a little bit more of a price point to those. But, I mean, heck, some of that's just that they're from either Mexico or they're protected or whatever. And so that's, you know, we're into the issue of keeping stuff because it's rare, keeping stuff because it's genuinely cool in and of itself. And there is crossover, but, you know, some of the time I think it's just because of the former. So.
Right. I mean, the some venomous species that I see that are even still somewhat popular are the some of the major ones, like the Gaboon vipers are always popular because people like gaboons. They get nice and big. They get big and impressive. And they're wonderful display animals. So gaboon vipers are never going to go the frick away. People are always going to buy gaboon vipers. But I've seen morphs of monocle cobra all over the place. But eventually no one gives a damn about the morph of monocle cobra. It's still a monocle cobra. It's, you know, you think that a morph in a ball python market is in free fall. I've seen ghost monocle cobras go from like $50,000 to like $20 and a pat on the back, and you can have it. So it's, you know, it's one of those things. It's just that the whole thing of talking to this kid just kind of made it realize that a lot of these animals, I trust completely with the people who take the time, learn from a respected avenue, and can keep these animals in the proper caging. Looking back on it, you know, with my friend Chris, there was several times where there were animals in places that right now make me kind of shudder. We had a spitting cobra in a sweater box for an afternoon because we didn't have a cage ready. And what the hell were we thinking? So it's one of those things that it's almost like I don't want to see these people make the mistakes because I don't want to see anybody get bit. I don't want to see somebody's hand get turned into a meat grinder because they needed an adult male croc monitor. So there are other options.
certainly you have a point there. I mean, there certainly is, dude, even a full-grown green iguana or any of those iguanas, to be honest, are not, they're just not suitable pets. Like,
no, they're not happy.
But, like, dude, if the jaw power on those, you know, I mean, sure, I guess the croc is scary because of those claws, because of that tail, because they're so damn smart. Like, I get that, you know, but, dude, even, like, you show me a full-grown male, you know, fired-up iguana, that thing's scary business, too. I mean, I suppose I'd take that over the croc, but I wouldn't be super thrilled with either. You know what I mean?
Yeah. My friend Andrew is a monitor breeder, and he breeds black throats, white throats, mangroves, and he had croc monitors, and he's probably the only person in the entire state that I trust with those animals. And he is taller than me, is built like some sort of Viking, and he's going to burn your house at any moment and pillage your shit. But he got bit by the female mangrove monitor on the hand, which is a small monitor compared to all the other ones. Put him in the hospital for a week because he had a terrible reaction. His hand swelled up. They drew out of the wound a white protein-based something or other, which you can only can assume is some form of venom.
They're definitely hot. I mean, they're working there. You know, in 5,000 years, they'll be hot for sure. If they aren't, you know, they already have antibiotics.
Thank you. Yes, it's working. It's coming. So.
They're trying their best. Yeah, I mean, dude, I've seen it. You know, I couldn't resist. Cam got those, you know, fresh little baby, vibrant yellow crocs. And $900 later, I'm sitting there going, man, this thing is pretty terrifying, actually. You know, that's just, you know, 15 inches including tail, you know, and I'm looking at this thing and just holding it without gloves and whatever. But even just the look, it's the look in the eyes when, I mean, that thing is...
There's somebody home.
Nasty business. Yeah, and I think that we talked before about when they did the, when I was out at the zoo, one of those Sundays, the male croc monitor, they had him paired up, and the male croc monitor ended up dying. And so we're in there right in the... vet's office at the zoo doing this necropsy, and they've got the monitor flipped over and stuff. And, you know, this is the male, not the female, right? So this is smaller, still a significant animal. And they're getting out the, you know, power tools or whatever to cut into this bloke. And honestly, dude, the whole scene to me was just reminiscent of all these alien movies where, you know, as soon as the saw starts up, the thing just hops up off the table and kills us all. You know? Like, that was the feeling of it. You know, that was the feeling of it, and that left me saying, I mean, heck, even when, you know, I eventually moved on that croc, it was like there was no one I could feel comfortable selling that animal to. Ultimately, you know, one guy came, persuaded me or whatever, but I don't even think I got the $900 back. It was just like there's no one I can move. Obviously, this isn't going to work for me long term, and there was no one, you know, I basically gave it to, you know, got the best offer I could from the most reasonable, a.k.a. only person that seemed, you know, feasible, you know, to deal with this stuff. And who knows, man, it might have ripped his hand off by this point, I mean, or, you know, or died because he was afraid it would, you know, and not taking care of it. I don't know. But I would say that, you know, there aren't a ton of things, you know, reptile-wise that are really scary like that, and you know, I'd take the Komodo over one of those things any day of the week, dude. No question at all.
Jeez. So, yeah, I mean, it's almost like kind of want to guide some people, but, you know, you're going to make your own decisions and kind of see where the way the market tilts, which is funny because I don't know if you guys have noticed is that the market fluctuates when it comes to what is popular and rare and what isn't. A couple of years ago, we were able to grab up adult blackface white lips for like $100 a pop. And now if you find one, it's a grand and you're lucky that you found it. And it just almost seems like the rarity kind of seems to be what's drawing people to it. nowadays. So have you guys kind of seen anything kind of like that where species will roller coaster depending on its availability?
Well, that and captive breeding, too.
True. It kind of seems like nobody wants it until it's gone. And either now it's going to be captive bred and it's more expensive, or it's gone now.
Yeah, I mean, it depends what you're talking about, but, I mean, you take the white lips, just for an example. I mean, you got blacks and golds. I mean, how many captive-born babies are there a year? You know, I'm waiting on you, Owen, to get me a male.
If you're lucky, I'll have a few. But, you know, it's one of those that if the whole country is lucky, there's one really lucky, there's two clutches a year.
If that.
And there are a good handful of people working on this, people who are smarter and more dedicated than I am. So, you know, it kind of seems like it's one of those things. So
I
totally
get
what you're saying,
though,
Scott.
You can get wild caught white lips, you know, pretty regularly, depending on who you get it from. I mean, my girl came from Ben Siegel, and she's perfectly healthy. I mean, I have no problem with it. I know she was, you know, farm bred or quote-unquote, doesn't matter what it is, it's wild caught to me. But, you know, it depends who you get it from. I'm happy with the one from Ben, but there's, you know, I love looking at king snakes, the other python stuff, and some of the places I see white lips available. I think I saw a male available not too long ago for a decent price, and I was like, yeah, half the people on there I'm not going to trust getting the snake from. And then, again, I'm trying to wait for captive-born male. I'm not in a rush. You know, I think part of it is we should get him to breed anyway. But, you see some wild-caught ones, not blacks, obviously, but golds anyway. You do see them available. But, again, there's no captive-born stuff. So, I mean, that's just one example, though. I mean, there's probably 500 examples of animals like that or, like you said, that are just hard to get now, especially.
Yeah, it almost seems like if they were prevalent and everywhere and then something happened, and because nobody really kind of, it almost seems like if it's coming in regularly as a wild-caught or farm-raised animal, it takes a special kind of person to want to sit down and figure out how to captive breed it. And no one cares about captive breeding it until now all of a sudden the imports are gone. And that almost seems to be what's going on with a lot of different species, is that since the wild ones are coming in or the farms ones are coming in, why try to figure out breeding it when you're going to try to offer your baby for a little bit higher when this guy's going to just bring in more for $100? It almost seems like it's kind of detrimental. And then once the importation shuts down, now there's a need to attempt to keep the species in the market. So now everybody rushes around and grabs a bunch and tries to breed it, but you know, you only have a select number of individuals. Sometimes bad stuff happens, you know, and you end up losing stuff. So it's tricky. Rob, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I mean, those market forces are at play. I mean, it's why we don't see more, you know, locality-type chondros bred in the United States, right? Because it's just this perception, right, that at this point it's not worth the effort. And, I mean, heck, we've seen that. I remember the black white lip thing, dude. Although I would say that I don't even think it was as – I wouldn't even view it as pessimistically, right? I remember back – so the big restart on them, as I recall, was like 05 or 06, something like that. And I remember over the course of maybe 3 or 4 months, Cameron got them in 3 or 4 times, and I bought animals, you know, from them each time, even – giant females, you know, 8-9 foot monsters that for the most part were, you know, pretty docile and stuff and adjusted, and whatever. There was one that nailed the shit out of me, and that was always funny. He'd always get on my case about bleeding all over his floor. So he said, you know, eventually got to the point of you're just, you know, here's the fucking mop, dude. And I remember that vividly happening on the back of my bicep with one of those big black females. But, I mean, I would say that those men, you know, there was strong interest in those animals, not only in myself, but, you know, I think basically all those animals we, you know, resold. And even at that point, man, they were, you know, hitting that $500, $600, $700 price point. And they were, you know, they were gone. The interest was certainly there. in those, because even so when that happened, right, I think it had been 3 or 4 or 5 years since he'd had them. And so,
yeah.
You know, people were already kind of fired up for it, and they came in and it was dispersed. But honestly, I think part of it, right, is just A, access, and B, money. Like, I think that's the one thing that we sometimes, you know, I just don't want to lose focus of, right, is people say, oh, you know, no one kept track of, you know, blackhead bloodlines from, you know, back in the mid to early 90s. Like, yeah, well, actually, there's a handful of people you should blame for that. And I would say painting with the broad brush of saying no one cared is inaccurate. I would say people who could afford a $20,000 pair of snakes might not have cared. You know what
right.
I mean? Like, it's not no one cared. I'm sure there were hundreds, you know, in that instance, literally hundreds of people in the United States who would have loved to work with Pilbara black-headed pythons. And it's unfair to say no one cared, no one kept track. Yeah, actually the people who didn't keep track were the people who said, you know what, I'm just going to get the most money I can. And that's
right.
The highest purchase here. And, I mean, shit, dude, we all know, right, that frequently the person who has the money to pay, you know, the best price is not the best situated to take care of it, whether in terms of experience with the species or just caring about the species or whatever, you know, we all, that's just a fact of life, right? That's how life goes. And I just don't want to, I'm always hesitant to say, oh, no one cared. It's no one who had the access to the money, you know,
right.
Who was in a position to make a difference cared. And some of it, man, is just the, you know, I would say the information, you know, the misappropriation of information, the misdirection that happens in the market, right? And for you know, a solid reason. Heck, with the ring pythons, I know you like rings. Like,
yes.
The funniest thing to me is always that, oh, you know, everyone used to breed them and, you know, no one cares about rings anymore and blah, 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 blah. We hear that all the time, right? That's the constant refrain. And what's being ignored is that from, like, the late 70s through the early to mid 90s, thousands of them were illegally smuggled into the United States. Thousands. It wasn't that they necessarily, I mean, sure, people were breeding them, and more people were working with them, but it's because there was this, you know, steady influx, and there was a heck of a lot cheaper, you know what I mean?
Right.
They're more accessible, and, I mean, the real key point is, like, oh, but more were being produced, then it's also, like, actually, the bigger thing is that they were being smuggled in and people were presenting them as captive bred when in fact they were smuggled animals, and the feds got wise to the way they were being smuggled and now they're not being smuggled anymore, as far as I know.
Right.
And it's like, oh, it's not that people didn't care or, you know, cared then, don't care now, vice versa. It's the people with access to the information weren't honest with us in the first place. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
So I
right. The people who were bringing them in were lying and doing
honest,
shit.
You know, and whatever.
Yeah.
And it's like, honestly, I don't, you know, they're animals, right? So I'm not anti-smuggling on a moralist ground by any means. I mean, heck, I think we should be working with this stuff. I think the threat to wild animals is humanity, right? And so really we have an obligation to try and do what we can to get them into captivity and work with them and do right by them. You know, if we're, like, heck, Tanimbar is the perfect example, right? If the stats are true, if it's really 98% deforested, those things are screwed, dude. You know?
Yeah, they're done.
Like, they're screwed. And even if they turn into these patternless silver snakes, they're screwed, you know? And if they're not screwed, it's because they're living in apartment buildings.
right, and they're going to be screwed that way, yeah.
Yeah, you know what I mean? And so I get that, and I think I think that species should be worked with. What I'm not on board with at all, and I think we're all, you know, in the same boat, both in terms of stuff that's legal or illegal, is to say, I just don't want it to be about the money. If it's about preserving the species, you know, that's my beef with, you know, in a certain sense, with Crutchfield, even with Hank Moll a little bit, to a lesser degree than Crutchfield, is like, dude, if your only interest, like, Hank strikes me as he's into the rare snake, and that happens to coincide with something that's worth a lot of money to some.
Right.
But, like, a lot of these guys, man, it's clearly just, that's a dollar sign, right? You know, am I getting blackheads because they're cool and I think they're badass, or am I getting blackheads because at the time they're selling for tens of thousands of dollars? Clearly the latter.
Right.
And I think that's
right.
Bullshit.
Right.
You know, if you're,
right.
If you're just about it, like, I mean, heck, dude, if people cared, if it was about how cool is this little thing, people would keep Pygophus, right, the little scaly foots from Australia. And yet the
yes.
only one I've ever seen was at Lowry Park Zoo, and it actually was smuggled. It was a confiscation, and that thing was badass. And I'm sure they're damn near impossible to breed just looking at the dang things and, you know, all this stuff. But if it was about that's just a badass critter, those the only one I'd ever seen wouldn't have been, you know, that single specimen.
It's almost like with the rough scales being like horribly, hideously endangered species, and then getting into the pet trade and then breeding like bunny rabbits to the point where I'm pretty sure in Australia they're going to be giving them away in Happy Meals. So it's, you know, it's one of those.
You know, I mean,
awesome.
Honestly, and I know the negative associated with that from a breeder standpoint or whatever, but, dude, I mean, that's awesome. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure people were trying to get to the Kimberley to smuggle those animals out beforehand. You wouldn't do it now. Although I would say that, you know, from what I hear, you know, if folks are interested in those, they should hop on that train, because I think some of the folks who have been working with them, you know, might be going in different directions and stuff. So I think if folks see those available and it's a thing you want to be working with, you know, it might be wise to pursue that sooner than
yeah,
later.
Definitely. I completely agree. But
you know, right, if they're not worth as much, then the folks who, you know, produce them consistently or, you know, are putting those numbers out there might move on to something else, dude. And then,
yep.
You know, I sure as heck don't want to see those things be gone, because as you, you know, as I know, you feel, they're badass little snakes, dude.
Well, they're awesome, which is like, you know, a moment of contention amongst a lot of people. So I'll definitely be getting on that one if, you know, people need to buy some damn super caramels. Anyway,
I saw your ads, dude. Those are pretty sweet.
I love them. The colors.
You know, I'm just saying.
I know. I'll accept trades for rough scales, so you can get those. It's always, this is my favorite time of year right now, just because eggs are coming soon. And then once you get babies, I mean, one of the main things, I was talking this weekend with my girlfriend about the market and what we do. She breeds geckos and tarantulas, and, you know, I'm the Python guy. So it's one of those things where we're discussing, one of the main things we have at the ball python market is that the females are raised to a certain, I hate that everything is in grams. There's always that picture of a ball python sitting on a scale, and it's at this many grams, and you know it's because that at a certain number of grams, that thing can breed. And, you know, I know that my girls have to be a certain weight to breed. I also have to be a certain age to breed. You know, and I always tend to take my time, wait till they're 4 years old to breed them, and then I'm kind of attached, and I want to see what the babies are going to look like, because I've been raising this girl from a hatchling, and I'm all excited. It's not like, oh, I've had this thing for a year, and now it's going to pop up babies up instead. So, you know, it's one of those things, the issue that I have. But going back to the rare stuff, it always seems like there's also a flux, like you were saying, with the tax of the dollar sign. From what I'm seeing, if somebody will throw up a trio of, let's just use Savu, throw up a trio of Savu for $500, and all of a sudden, a week later, that ad is gone. And now everybody who has a trio of Savu that's sitting in the back of their cages somewhere is like, holy crap, that's $500 just sitting there. And then all of a sudden, for 2 months straight on Kingsnake and Fauna, all you see is Savu of every kind. Babies, adults, mediums, everything. Wild caught, farm raised, whatever. And they're all over the place. And then eventually those all get sold out for varying stuff, and then you won't see Savus on those ads for months until someone throws it up again. So you almost think like the rare reptile kind of a thing is almost like a wave that we create.
Scott? I don't know. I mean, you're talking about Savus, and they're not always available. They're always available in, like, two places, but not somewhere I'm going to get them. But, I mean, there's very rarely adults available. Yeah, pretty rare anyway. Who picked them up? There's a couple people that's picked up adults lately, but most of it's babies. I mean, that's what I hear a lot of on the Deliasis page I got. People are looking for
right.
babies. They're just freaking badass, though, man, the Savus. I don't know if the flux, I know you're saying it's a flux based on, you know, rarity, but I they're not superly available. I wish they were
right.
available. I mean, I got my pair, and God, they are just freaking badass snakes, man. You know, they're not bright and flashy, but they're easy to keep, just like carpets, and then they're just super active, and my male is super tame. That helps. But I don't know. It's one of those things. It depends on the animal, too. I mean, you got
right.
Savus. There's a million different animals that the market works differently.
Rob, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I'm with you know, and I certainly have seen the same thing, and we do see it all the time with different species, you know, and it's, I think you're onto something, saying, hey, an ad gets posted for X, Y, or Z, and, you know, I have some of those too, and I'll post those up, whether they sell or not, I'll see that, and I actually, speaking as though I have a King Snake account, I don't, I used to, but that's sort of, that sort of thing, like, yeah, no, I know what you're talking about, you know, and I've seen that too. The thing that bums me out is when you see those same, I mean, I know, and you can speak to this more, and I remember this, excuse me, from, oh, I don't think I've had a King Snake account for 5 or 6 years, but, you know, I did have one for 4 or 5 years and posted consistently throughout that time, and it always bums me out to see someone repost the same ad at the same price point with the same information and the same picture for, you know, months. Like, man,
yeah.
what are you thinking? Like, who is it that you think, I mean, I don't check it nearly as much as I used to, but honestly, I still probably check my favorite sections every day or at, you know, worst every other day or something like that. And even the ones that really aren't my favorite sections, but I have a passing interest in, I probably see those every week at least. So I've seen your head, dude. Your snakes just aren't worth $2,000. I'm sorry. You know what I mean? WVS,
yeah.
Dude. I am calling your ass out because he's the worst offender for this. Like, you had the same ad for 3 years. There's no one cares. Like, and it's not
that
no one cares about your snake. Your price is wrong. Like,
exactly.
You just don't
so you got to adjust or take a better picture of it or something. Yeah.
Right.
So.
I mean,
you mean those high yellow jungles with no pictures of parents are not worth what they say?
Well, of course, because it's a VPI, right? Yeah. So.
Oh. Those in every other jungle, right? You know.
Exactly. Every single jungle on the planet.
So yeah, no, I mean, I think you're onto something there, and I think there is some aspect of saying, oh, maybe this, you know, these Savus are $500. I think the Savus are a different example. Like I was talking about, they're badass, and I mean, heck, dude, as I think the thing that limits the number of adults you see is just as wild caughts, those things are damn near impossible. You know, I mean, in the early days, right, it took, you know, huge numbers to get some of them to produce, you know, and even with really good keepers, Roger Klingenberg, famous vet who's up in Greeley, Colorado here, you know, worked with them extensively, didn't produce any, you know, over those first few years, finally produced some 3, 4, 5 years down the road after having adult females, you know, all that time. I know at the zoo, right, we had this, what was that, it was either three or four. It was a trio or a two pair on display together for, well, when they first started coming in, so something like 94 through early 2000s, so like 8 or 9 years, these snakes came in as adults, sat there, cycled, you know, whatever, for 8 or 9 years, finally said, ah, you know, they're not doing anything, this is frustrating, let's put in something that's flashier, does whatever, you know, and this has been a very frustrating project. And, you know, wouldn't you know it, sells them to Cameron, and either they laid eggs at his place or they laid eggs for, they must have laid eggs at his place or we wouldn't have heard about it.
Right.
We worked on it for 8 or 9 years, sold them, and within, you know, 2 weeks or whatever, they're dropping eggs. You know, so that's just kind of funny. But I think that's, you know, I think that's honestly should be true with all sorts of adult stuff. I mean, and I think it takes some maturity, but I've reached the point, you know, with my collection where I'm really, I don't need to be buying adult stuff, and I don't think that's necessarily a good plan. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Like,
you don't know what has gone into that animal or what it's been exposed to or any of those things. And, I mean, the same is true, honestly, with a small animal, but at least you know the limited time window, right? And you can
Right. You're not dealing with 5-6 years. You're dealing with, like, one. So.
Right. You know, well, 5-6 years or 20, dude, who knows? You know, and there's something cool about that, too. I like old snakes, and they look cool, you know? But at the same time, in terms of, like, you have your collection, I think a lot of people have figured out maybe running through adult stuff is not a really good call, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's certainly a true thing, and I think, you know, whether it's in terms of getting them to produce or just, like, wow, that's a nasty virus that it, you know, picked up from being exposed to all these different snakes in 15 different collections over the 20 years that it's been alive or whatever.
Awesome. But it does make sense. It is something that I've kind of wrestled with when we were talking about bringing in certain animals that you couldn't really find here, white lips and other things like that. It's like, well, how long have they been out there, and what have they been doing, and what they're exposed to? It's almost easier to start with a cleaner slate. We have 2 3-year-old Malukans that we imported as tiny little red babies. They were, like, I thought I killed them at one point because I was touching them and their skin ripped. And I'm like, oh my God. So it's, and just raising those two up. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't know that.
That's great. You know, and heck, dude, I'll even take, I think there is a lot to be said for the fact that wild adult snakes, particularly females, are very difficult to breed. I don't think it's impossible for most of them. But I would say that, you know, and I've told this to Eric before, and I think he feels the same way, is, dude, if you're going to give me an adult snake, I'd rather it be a wild-caught adult snake that, you know, just came into Cameron's last week than some random unidentified thing that's been floating through God knows how many collections here in the United States and exposed to species from all over and, you know, got just an exponential factor, right, of snakes that it's been exposed to. Like, imagine, like, oh, well, this place had 20 snakes, and this place had 20 snakes, and this place had 20 snakes, and they were all from different places, different collections, or they were wild or whatever, and it's just like, wow, man, these animals are very hardy, or these things would be dropping left and right with all the stuff that we expose them to.
Yeah, yeah. I almost like it that our one female came from our one female blackface came from Nick, who got it straight from Cam, like, the hour after it landed in his place as a hatchling, a week after it was hatched. So it's like, this thing is pretty much captive, even though it's kind of got that little side thing on it, and it's pretty cool. And she's better behaved than our captive born and bred male. He's a dick. So it's one of those things where sometimes captive don't mean nice. So it's pretty cool with that. Now, have you guys seen, there is kind of like a stigma right now where everybody, and I kind of, I'm a member of the Rare Reptile Classifieds on Facebook, and I almost kind of live on there because it's always cool to see the weird shit that's coming through, whether it's a gecko with, you know, freaking spikes or some funky, weird-looking kind of an animal. It's always cool to see that to me. But it almost seems like the rare species and the rare normal species without a morph are kind of taking precedence. And a lot of people are kind of scoffing and looking down at anybody who breeds a morph, which is weird because the market has done a complete, like, 360 to, or like 180 to what it used to be. Normally it was you breed the morphs because that's what people want to see. But now people kind of want to see the rarer stuff. Have you guys seen that, or are we thinking, like, this is our first round of reptile hipsters where I was into water pythons before they were cool? So I'm not sure yet.
I think part of that was those actual Facebook groups that helped. I mean, because for, I don't know, 12 years, the first couple snakes I got were bread and butter, but after that I always liked having stuff that was different, not necessarily everybody had. So, and the other thing is, back then, I used to look through books, and, you know, I saw a white-lip python in a book before I had one, and scrub pythons and all these venomous stuff. So I think now what you're seeing, at least with the Internet, is, you know, instead of going to the shows only and seeing ball python and saying, oh, that's all there is, now that people can see there's some other badass shit out there, man. Like, I agree, man. Some of those geckos they put up, oh, my God. The Euromastics that are just like, well, you see what Bayhoff puts shares all the time. Holy shit.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think that helps it. I don't know necessarily if it's against the morphs, but, I mean, I'm choosing not to do really any morphs. The only morphs I'm going to have, funny enough, will be the dark side, IJs. I have a little granite project with that, but that's for now. But I thought about doing zebra jungles, and I'm like, I'm not even doing that. I'm just going to do normal jungles, selective breed of Sabus, normal white. But I don't know if there's anyone necessarily going against people breeding morphs, but I just think there's more exposure to that rare stuff that is badass without being a morph.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm with Scott. I think it's a lot of exposure. What I would say is I think the reason we had, you know, the reason it was in a, you know, cyclical low, at least my, you know, own hypothesis on that would be, you know, a lot of the people who were newer, you know, right, started keeping or exposing themselves to information in the last, oh, nine years, something like that, right? There, a lot of that exposure is coming online as opposed to from books or from Vivarium, you know, Reptiles Magazine is shit these days, but, you know, or Reptile and Amphibian Hobbyist or all this different stuff, right, where if you had come into it like we did 4, 5, 6 years or more earlier, that would have been what you were exposed to, and you would see those magazines or those books, and as Scott indicated, there would be all sorts of different stuff in there, right? It wouldn't just be the problem now or problem if you've only joined in the last 8 years or so is you go to a site, and the site will have all ball pythons, only info on ball pythons, or all leopard geckos, only info on leopard geckos, crest to get, whatever, bearded dragon, whatever it might be, it seems like the monoculture of people's collections has really shot up. And so you'll see, if you're strictly web-based or your exposure is web-based, you'll look in and say, oh, well, all this guy thinks, you know, all Ralph Davis thinks are cool are ball pythons. I think boas too, maybe, I don't, you know, or whatever. But, like, for the most part, oh, it's ball pythons. Same thing, you know, across the board. I know Brian's different, but he didn't have a website up until recently. And I think that's really what's driving that. Whereas if you'd gotten in earlier, you would have those magazines and you'd have an appreciation for Morph California Kingsnake. Heck, this is funny, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I'll pull up the issue here. I saw this the other day. I was, you know, sitting looking through my collection of Vivarium magazines. And I saw an ad, or a, kind of a breeder's choice thing from Vivarium from, oh, let's see, Mullington. What year is this? This would be, I think, 98. And it has the silver Sabu python in it, right?
So oh, my God.
You see with Mark and Kim Bell. So I didn't realize that snake, you know, I figured, oh, it must be they produced it, you know, it came out of just breeding them or whatever. Dude, the snake was originally owned by, let's see, you know, it's these picture classifieds in the back, and he's posting this thing saying, oh, check out my silver Sabu python. And as I say, this is 98. And so it's not that this stuff is new or wasn't around or whatever. It's, we just, again, it's an information thing, right? And if you weren't around to see this, either at the time or if you're just like me and you're just scanning through these old issues or whatever, I had assumed the Bells had produced it just out of nothing. You know, that was my assumption. Oh, it's in this this article from Seward, Butch Diggins of Danny Neonates, right? You know, it's like, well, presumably that's who first produced it. So I have no idea who Butch Diggins is of Danny's Neonates from this April 99 Vivarium, but, you know, it's not the Bells who produced that animal. It's, you know, Butch. And I think that's pretty crazy. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But seeing
that,
otherwise you wouldn't know. And I think actually, Owen, I got to give you props. I think you're on the exact right track with what you do with your website in terms of having information on all the animals you're working with. Not in terms of species, but like this is this particular snake, right? And
yeah.
I think that's what we need. I'm changing my site right now to mimic that same idea because, honestly, I don't know why someone would, you know, I don't want just your random snake. I want to be choosing based on all the stuff. And if you're not willing to give me that information, really, dude, like, these are luxury reptiles, right? As I think it was Nick who categorized them that way, right? And, like, without that information, I just don't have the interest. It doesn't have to be fancy. It doesn't have to be, oh, you know, grandiose. It's just I want to feel like I'm making a good decision and that you care about it and that we all know what's going on and it's just not some throwaway animal. And I think if we as an industry move more towards that, that's only going to be good for us, you know. So in a way, heck, I'd be glad to see us produce fewer, you know, jaguar siblings and stuff. And even, I mean, actually, that's a whole other issue, and I don't know if we were going to hit on that or not. But, like, you know, I had sent to Eric a website of a kind of looks to be newbie ball python guy, right? So looks, from the looks of it, spent a lot of money probably getting into snakes in, I think, 2011, something like that. And I think newly getting into snakes, what was the site? It was kind of fun. Oh, Cape Fear Python, something like that. Which is, you know, funny because of the I've never actually seen the movie, but The Simpsons.
Spoof. Neither have I, but, you know, and I'm pretty sure I'm committing sacrilege.
Right. But on there, what's really cool, well, two things are cool. One that's just kind of interesting and fun is seeing this news page or breeding updates page or journal or whatever you want to call it of this guy who clearly went hog wild, went from nothing to hog wild and obviously spent a lot of money and it appears to be having some success, but I don't know if it's success selling snakes. It's just he seems to be producing some stuff and having a good time, and I hope he's getting out of it what he wants. But, you know, so that's kind of fun. And I, you know, that's not me being negative. That's genuinely, that's, I enjoy that. That's fun, you know, for me to read. Not, it's not me, but it's still, I can appreciate it, and I appreciate that he's being positive about what he's doing. The other thing is this site contains links about all the problems associated with all the morphs with which he works. And if you go to his available page, there's a link on there that says, oh, interested in this desert ball python? Interested in this spider ball python? If, you know, if you are, then you need to check out this page that has quirks or issues associated with that gene. So that, I mean, that's full disclosure. That's awesome.
Yeah, it is.
That's awesome.
Absolutely.
And I understand it's easy, much easier, right, for him being the new guy and, you know, trying to make a name for himself, but also coming from kind of a different place, right? He's not a pro breeder by any means. You know, it's easier for him to do that than it would be, you know, for even Brian, you know, to do that. But at the same time, man, that's awesome. Because as discussed, you know, at length before, right, your snakes should be, it's not that they will sell themselves, but they should be able to, when honestly represented, be worth the money that you're asking for them. Or you're lying.
Right.
Or you're lying. If you're relying on a lack of information in your audience, they're going to be dissatisfied, whether it's today, tomorrow, whether it's with you, or just the whole thing in general. Like, they're going to be dissatisfied somewhere along the line. Whereas if, I mean, heck, dude, you know, you say, my super caramel male is worth 800 or 900 bucks or whatever it is. I just looked at it this morning. Like, I'm with you. And as far as I know, there's no issues with that. But I tell you what, dude, if there was and you knew about it and I didn't know about it, I'd be fucking
pissed. Oh, I'd be pissed. Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, whether it's that individual animal, you saying, like, oh, I know he has an imperfection here, there, whatever, and I'm not going to disclose it. Or if it's, oh, well, it turns out, you know, gene X, you know, all of, I mean, heck, dude, honestly, I can't lie. The super zebra tail thing, to me, that's a, I can't do it. Like, I couldn't do that, dude. You know, that's, the zebras are badass, but, like, I'm, you know, not raising pigs here. You know what I mean? Personally, I
they don't want to curse the tail.
But, you know, like, I'd dock the tails if it was me, but it also,
I've docked tails before.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's fine, but at the same time, you can't say that doesn't bum you out. You know what I mean? Like, when it hatches out, like, what was that cool one? There was a super zebra, exanthic super zebra or whatever, right, that was posted.
I think so.
Man, the fact that it's sitting there hiding its, you know, vent or, you know, the dorsal above the vent, right, where the vent sat, and its tail in that picture, man, it's a cool-looking critter, but that tells me that, A, that has a spinal depression above the vent, and that it's got a big tail. Like, if it didn't, you wouldn't take that picture. That wouldn't be the picture you'd take. It would look better.
You want a full body shot.
Yeah. You wouldn't take that picture. The fact that you did tells me that that's the problem. And, You know how I know? The boutique blood python does the same damn thing. They have that, looks like they were wet clay. You push down on them above the vent, gives them a little depression, and they have the tails that are messed up. Like, dude, I get it. You know, it doesn't make them bad snakes, but I do want you to own it. You know what
yeah.
I mean? Like, own
yeah.
it's got that issue. Because if I hatch out my first ones and they all look messed up, and I call you and say, hey, dude, have you ever seen this? And you say, yeah, they all hatch out that way, or even 90% of them hatch out that way. Ooh, I would be pissed.
Oh, my God. I'd be
so pissed. It's great.
I would have lost my damn mind. I mean, and it's always funny because the big one is my Jags have no Nero, or my Jags have never shown Nero, or my line is from this place where there's no Nero. It's and the big thing is that if you look at it across the board, there's always seems to be a morph and always seems to be something wrong. And there always seems to be another species or another animal morph that does the same damn thing. Like you were just talking about with the super zebras and the bloods. I mean, look at spider ball python and jaguar. It's always there. And, you know, they haven't fixed it over there. What makes you think you can fix it over here? So.
Yeah, I mean,
that
I guess,
is why
and,
I have no jags.
Right? I mean, that's the thing. And Owen, I know how you feel about them. And I know how a lot of people feel about them. I know I'm in the minority with this. I'm glad Scott agrees with me. Like, dude, I'm at the local show, I guess, coming up on 3 months ago, and someone has a spider head clown or some sort of ball python that they want significant money for, $300, $400, $500, right? And this thing's sitting in the display, and the damn thing is completely upside down.
It's not even trying
to right itself. It's laying there on its back, and it's not upset about it. It's just like, this is cool. You know, this is life. This is legit. Whatever.
I can hang here, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and my feelings, see, I mean, that's disquieting to me. And my reaction is, dude, I wouldn't take it if you offered it to me for free. Honestly, I wouldn't take it even if you offered me money as well, because it's just not my thing. Like, to me...
Mm.
That ruins it. I know for other people it doesn't, and that's great. But for me, it ruins it. And honestly, that animal wasn't being represented as anything weird. And it honestly, it may not be weird for spider ball pythons. Maybe they do that. I've never seen one personally do anything that extreme, even when I was taking care of them, some of the collection and Pro Exotics and stuff. I never saw them do that. But, like, I don't know, man. If I walked in and it was doing that, that would just
kind of freak out.
And that would ruin it to me.
Dude, I've seen it at White Plains multiple times.
Yeah.
Exactly what you said. That gene, and you walk by, and there's a ball python on its back or, you know, really bad. And like I said, that's why I don't have any jags. Just, I don't care if people do. I mean, it is what it is, but I just don't like the Nero. I really don't.
Okay. Is that also why you're not doing zebras, because of the super form and the tail?
No. I don't know. That's not why I'm not doing zebras. I just decided not to. I don't know. I see a lot of people doing morphs, and I said, you know what? I'm just going to do what I like doing, which is I'm happy with just nice jungles.
Yep. And you know what? Everybody needs good-looking jungles. So it's... Not
right.
Like you're going to go broke there, yeah.
To be honest,
yeah.
You know, it's selectively
pretty much.
More cute, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, so, no, it's not an anti-morph thing. It's not, and there are morphs that are objectively or appear to be fine, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's great. I mean, dude, this was funny. I guess it was you guys, or maybe it was on their new show, but, you know, Bill was talking about, oh, ball pythons have, like, more morphs than any snake. I actually would have to disagree. My exposure to it has been that blood pythons actually have, I mean, red bloods, python bronchers, my right, have more natural mutations than any other species. They would blow ball pythons out of the water in terms of base mutations. It's just that they take more space, and they're more finicky, and you need to kind of do a couple different things to keep them well. So we're not seeing it. Tracy has all these unproven things, and everyone else can do it, too. Some people do. But, I mean, honestly, I don't think there's a normal blood python. There are certainly normal ball pythons. I don't think there's a normal blood python.
Really?
And, yeah, oh, for sure. I've seen them at camps, picking out all those animals. I mean, heck, dude, they're awesome, and I love that. You know, Eric's always talking about Dinker carpets. The bring down for Dinker carpets, even the Dinker IJs, would be that there just aren't enough of them brought in. I think the CITES allocation on them is only – I want to say 120 snakes a year or something like that. It's really, it's not high.
Wow.
As compared to the blood pythons, which is, well, at least it was, like 5,000 live for reds. So, I mean, I think, you know, that's the thing that limits those as opposed to ball pythons that were what? That are probably now 10,000, 20,000, something like that, but they were up at 100,000, something like that. Like, it's just a numbers thing, but if people were watching blood pythons, they'd do the same thing. And heck, who knows with carpets, they're so inherently variable. The same thing's probably true. And hell, we all know, right, Eric's about to hatch his, well, hopefully he'll get some eggs and then hatch out his new $5,000 melanistic IJs. That'll be
Jeez, well, no one knows. No one knows. And you know what? I hope he does. He has a good season this year because it's always fun having him right down the road from me. And last year, the only time he called me was when something was going horribly wrong with one of his with his caramel who was bound up. So, you know, I always like going over to see Eric's place because I'm like, this is a cool place. What's going on? And he starts opening up drawers, and I start seeing snakes, and I'm like, Jesus Christ, I want it. So he's a terrible influence on me. All I had was coastals before I started this show. So anyway, it almost seems like that's the morphs and the wild type kind of needs to go hand in hand, in my opinion. But you know, to his own. Now another thing that I posted up on Facebook earlier this week, I don't know if you guys saw that, were the weirdest things that I've been offered in a trade. The weird things I've been offered in a trade. I was just offered a pit bull puppy for a tiger carpet. And was directed to a website of a guy who looked like his dogs had taken some form of steroid. I mean, I didn't know there were that many muscles on these freaking animals, but, yeah, no dice. But that made me think about it, and I've actually been offered a pit bull puppy, a motorcycle, and my favorite was actually a cassowary chick. Was somebody years ago...
Wow.
Was that...
That's a handful.
Yeah. Well, yeah, well... This guy apparently years ago offered me a baby cassowary chick for, I think he wanted like three or four jaguars, and this was back in like 2009. So jaguars had been around. They were kind of like everywhere, and they're only about $300 a pop. So why did this guy want a cassowary? For me, it was kind of weird, but I turned him down because what the hell am I going to do with a cassowary? So that was what was funny. So I don't know if either one of you guys have been offered like crazy shit for your snakes. Scott?
Oh, no, not really. I mean, I think years ago when I sold some stuff, I've probably been offered, you know, something like probably some electronic stuff, but I really haven't been offered anything crazy. I can't beat cassowary chick. I can't beat that, so I think an extra 60 or something is not going to touch that.
Well, see, now my thing is say you trade and you get the Xbox, you plug it in, and it's shit. Like, it's been gutted or something, and it doesn't work.
Yeah. No,
so.
I've never been one to trade anyway, so.
Yeah.
But, no, I can't really say I've been
offered
anything that would be shocking.
The other thing I was offered, and you'll actually enjoy this, Scott, I was offered a compound bow with, like, scopes and 200 arrows.
Fuck yeah.
See, you would. See, Scott's a bow hunter, so I know that he would be like, yes.
No, I think I actually was, oh, God, what was I getting rid of? At one point, I think I was offered something like that. I think it was guns, though. I can't remember.
See, that makes me nervous. you trade a gun, trade a snake to guns, and all of a sudden the cops are knocking on your door. Yeah, no, thank you. So
it wasn't bad. It was more along the lines of a hunting gun or something.
Mm-hmm.
But again, no. I mean, I'm good on guns and bows and stuff. So I was like, no, man, I'm good. I can't remember exactly what it was, but yeah, I think that was probably the weirdest thing. But yeah, no, I would have took the bow.
It's going to be like, I have some disposable arrows now.
Yeah, really. I got some ground going.
Rob, did you get anything crazy?
No, not really. I mean, I think man, you should have gone with the cassowary. You might have missed it at this point, but yeah, I really think she should have rock and rolled with that. I think the only thing that I was prompted to was saying, I remember a pretty funny guy who's from, I want to say Arkansas or something like that, who told me, oh, I'm really interested in this Sulawesi retic that you have, but I need to go sell some guns first. You know, but that was about, that's the only thing that I was prompted to from that. I think the trade thing is a little bit, you know, unless it's animal for animal with someone you know and you really have an interest in that, or you're flipping animals, you know, there's not really, I think it's Barcheck, right, who says the best trade is, you know, my snake for your money, so.
yeah, that makes some sense. I mean, I've been offered animals with the intent of, well, if you take it, you can sell it, and then you'll get your money, and then I go, or I'll take it, and it'll sit in my snake room for 3 years, and then I'll want to kill you. So, I mean, that's kind of just been how...
crazy shit than get offered, I don't know how many years ago, I had bred my VPI jungle when they were like 4 years old. The worst part that I really hated was like when someone local would be like, you know, hey, I'll give you $100 for one. And I can get two of those on Kingsnake for $100. I'm like,
oh, Jesus Christ.
Go get two of them.
I hate that, and I've said that to where somebody's like, I can get this for $100 less. I'm like, why are you talking to me? You should run and go do that. I mean, it's the low ball offers are always amazing. So that's always the
cassowary.
Everyone should just get offered cassowaries. So this little question came direct from Mr. Burke, who's hanging out in Jamaica right now, I hope is sitting down and lounging about with a drink with a small umbrella, you bastard. Anyway, this is, do you think that UV lighting is important and can add long-term health to the snakes? And this has been something I've been thinking about because, you know, obviously reptiles bask for several reasons, one definitely being that they need the heat. But what if UV has something to do with it? And I've been thinking about it more and more, especially when it comes to my Brettles carpets, because they're the ones who I've seen. Normally my animals get a little duller during the winter and breeding season. The Brettles went from being this really nice rusty color red to almost freaking brown, which I'm told will, you know, normally after breeding season, everybody sheds and everybody starts looking pretty again. But, does UV do anything? Rob, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's a tough deal, right? Because I've long been one kind of the Frank Rita school where, you know, you can keep monitors just with that. If you're just giving them heat, you can keep them in that cattle trough with the lights on 24/7. And heck, I mean, I've seen, you know, positive results doing the same thing even with tortoises and stuff where you're supposed to need to do that. I haven't kept bearded dragons and things where it's supposed to be required, and I kind of wonder if I could keep them in the same way productively. Certainly, right, metabolic bone disease, synthesis of D3, right, is a it's a real thing. But if you're using supplementation in those species that do have high D3 requirements, then I would say certainly it's been proven, right, that at least with some species, monitors, at a minimum, that you can do fine without providing that. Your mastic, same thing, right? You can
right.
do it fine. At the same time, like, I do think there's a lot going on in terms of pigmentation and behavior in these animals that we don't necessarily, you know, kind of really fully appreciate. I mean, heck, dude, the biggest thing that I've become a proponent of, fan of, is the chromatophore stuff, the super pigment offered by Rapashi. Like, I dust my mice with that stuff. I think that's a real, you know, those carotenoids they're an actual thing, right, that they're exposed to in the wild, because the rodent isn't just eating commercial rodent diet, right, in the wild. Actually,
right,
they're not eating
right.
at all. They're eating, you know, flowers and all sorts of different stuff, right? And I think that's a real thing, and I've seen so far positive results with that, and I think even if it's not necessarily a determinant factor, I don't think it hurts. I haven't seen any negative effects whatsoever. it does seem to have some paprika in it, so it's kind of, it's a little bit tough to dust a feeder, you know, you got to have an animal that's willing to take it and you're acclimatizing them to it or whatever, but, I mean, heck, dude, I, you know, who's to say, like, right, I have my little badass Arubiak times Meroki Chondro with all that white and stuff, and it's like, well, would he have had that if I wasn't dusting the ass ends of the, you know, pinks and then fuzzy mice that I'm feeding him? I don't know. You know, would he have more or less of those if I exposed him to UV? I don't know. But I would say that a lot of, right, we see all the time that those Merokis that are in captivity, I mean, Vladimir, I think, well, this would have been, I think, in Buddy's new show that they were talking about this, but Vladimir, who used to run the Cameron's farm over in Indonesia, had given an interview to this dude who, I don't know, he doesn't go by his real name on his website, which is always somewhat sketch, honestly, but apparently Condor folks know who this guy is. He talks to Vladimir, and Vladimir says, you know, or admits, like, a lot of these captive hatch chondros don't look as cool. Like, a captive hatched Aru is less likely to look badass than a, you know, wild one, in terms of white scale clusters and the high blue and even the Highland stuff doing that same sort of thing. And I know it's getting Condor nerd on you, Owen, but...
No, you're doing fine. I'm following so far. Keep going.
you know, like, those animals are different. So Biox, actually the captive ones end up looking crazier than the wild ones. Which is,
okay,
you know, as opposed to the Arus, where the opposite is true, and the Merukis, where the opposite is true. Like, those Merukis, right, the ideal image that I think actually isn't all that common in the wild, is my understanding, is they're this green snake with a white line of scales on their dorsal, right? They look striped with, like, a white stripe, single scale wide, white stripe, look like these Cape York animals in Australia. You know, those animals, the first generation farmed animals, or even, you know, captured bred here from wild ones that are full stripers, like, they don't look like that, dude.
Mm.
And the question is, why? Like, is it genetic, or is it, you know, environmental, as you suggest? I mean, I don't know. All I can say is I certainly will be, you know, continue to dust the ass end of my rodents with this, you know, super pig stuff. And if, frankly, if you popped them in with access to UV, maybe that would make a difference too. But the trouble is, unless you're working with hundreds of them, you'd never be able to say. You'd just be able to say, oh, well, if, you know, if I do those things, or if I do one or the other and someone else does the opposite, and we start seeing, oh, well, my percentage is much, much higher, much, much better, then there probably is something to that. And frankly, I would think that that's, my guess is that that will be proven accurate. Because certainly those, you know, chemicals, those compounds are doing something. You know, they certainly express, I mean, heck, they express themselves in all the animals I have that have any of those yellows or oranges that I feed that to. Even the Homahara scrubs, dude, like, man, they, you know, they look brighter, and even brighter than when I wasn't feeding them that stuff. You know, certainly my variable king snakes look brighter, you know, and it's, I think it's a real thing. The Womas look brighter, and I think that's a replication of nature, and it's why when we see these wild snakes, you see, I mean, heck, dude, those Pilbara Womas and stuff, right? You see them, and it's just, holy shit, that thing is awesome, you know? But if you kept that in its cage, as you're talking about with the predators, if you pop that into your tub for, you know, 6 months, it certainly wouldn't fill you with that same feeling. And I think a certain amount of that is seeing the animal in its habitat just has an extra grab-you-by-the-ball sort of feeling. But I think there is actually some difference too. You know,
true.
I think you're spot on, and, you know, I think Eric should test it out. Like, you know, pop some UV bulbs in there, man, you know, and make sure they're running, and, you know, it certainly makes them look cool. It's not feasible with my setup. I keep things in tubs. You know,
I can't do any of it.
You know, I can't do it. So what can I do? The thing I've seen is this super big stuff. And, you know, I'm running with that and seeing where it leads. That's the best I can do.
It makes sense. Scott, do you think that maybe UV would help with that, or even would you consider dusting your rodents with this Rapashi stuff?
Well, shit, man. If it means my jungle get more yellow,
sign me the frick up.
You know, he hit the nail on the head. I mean, I spent a lot of time just looking on REITs forum there and on that stuff, and like you said, you know, I know people are keeping Euros without it, without UV and stuff, successfully, as long as you get in the temps and, you know, the right supplementing and stuff. I don't think it's necessarily bad. I mean, obviously, we're all keeping snakes in tubs, and it's not hurting them. But I think he's right. Obviously, there's something going on there, and it could only be beneficial. It's not hurting if you give it to them. And I'm just like you guys. I don't have the ability to do that with all my snakes. Give them all UV, there's no way. But I agree. I think Eric should test it.
Well, all right. See, that now is the general consensus. Eric has to do shit. So when he listens to this on the plane, I want him to be like, the hell's going on? So, yeah, perfect. I like it. Eric, get the UV bulbs. Now, my other question is, like, the big thing is that I love it that the conversation always seems to drift towards, if I incubate at a higher temperature, does that mean I'm going to create fantastic-looking animals or a brand-new morph? I found that to be not true because I don't really think that genetics is based too much on heat. Will you get that random freakish little baby that just because it was incubated at a little bit of a different temp, it develops a kind of a sick-looking pattern? Sure, but I don't think you can alter too much. But that's one of those other rumors that I saw floating around on the Internet this week. Scott, what do you think?
I kind of agree with you. I mean, I don't think you're going to have something like, you know, a regular gene get messed up and all of a sudden you do have a new morph. But, yeah, you're going to have – I think it's certainly possible to have something change a little bit so you get, I don't know, pattern change or freakish-looking baby or, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I certainly am not going to mess with temperatures.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I mean, I hatched a two-headed once, and that was enough of a freakish thing for me. So, yeah.
I think it certainly happens.
Yeah, of course. So, Rob, what do you think?
Yeah, so I actually have a couple different ways to run with this. One, I would say, if I recall correctly, the Ross and Marzek book actually talks about kind of dehydrated eggs producing different-looking animals, you know, kind of out of accidental stuff, but getting striped. I think I remember, like, a striped berm, and it was from eggs that had been, you know, kind of not noticed and desiccated a bit before being incubated and stuff, and sure enough, they look funky, but it's not genetic. I mean, it's a cool-looking critter, and to the extent that we're keeping cool-looking critters, that's great, you know.
Mm.
I don't think it's something you can really do intentionally unless it's something that gets, like, really studied, right? So, like, albino leopard geckos, they're actually, because so many are produced, they've actually figured it out. Ron Tremper, like, worked it out. So that the female albino leopard geckos from his strain, presumably all strains, but, you know, he was working primarily with his own, like, his look less bright, less colorful, less pretty, you know, kind of in this public consciousness sense than male leopard geckos, and the reason for that is because they're being incubated cooler. And so he looked at that and figured out, well, how can I make a pretty female? And it turns out that the gender of the leopard gecko is set within the first, I think, 19 to 22 days of incubation. So that if you incubated it to be a female for that first 19 to 22 days, and then afterwards you cooked it at a male temperature, it would be a female because the gender would have been set, but it would actually be those higher temperatures tend to produce what we could consider prettier babies. So you put them into that female spot for 22 days, then you pop them in with the males, and you hatch out pretty females. Unfortunately, with those, actually, you know, it turns out that just exposing them to cooler temperatures, so like below 80 degrees or so, so if you cooled them for the winter, rather, if that was your cycling rather than a food cycle, they'll actually darken up to kind of that chocolate look. Anyway, so they'll change even after they're born and stuff.
So it doesn't matter. All right.
Yeah, you know, so that's just kind of funny. But, and I mean, those are pretty too. It's all, you know, all this stuff is in the eye of the beholder. But, you know, so that, it is a real thing. Or at least you can get different looks in some species. But, again, he was looking at literally thousands of eggs. And I think, you know, he was cutting them open at different dates. I mean, that's the only way he could be figuring out when that date would be that the sex is set and all this different stuff. So you need to take that
wow.
and approach with it to really know. The other thing I would say, because we've talked about this before, temperature sex determination in snakes, because I know you've presented that as being a possible thing, and everyone's, I think, familiar with it in geckos and, mm-hmm. you know, crocodilians, I think, as well. I have seen it in Asian rat snakes, rhino rats, cocci, all this stuff. So it's one of these things where a lot of people don't know that, don't realize that, but there's a reason that so the rhinos were first really kind of into the public consciousness in, you know, since their description and then redescription in the late 1800s, and then they were redescribed by a Chinese guy who didn't know he was redescribing them in 1920 or so, and then no one kept them for about 70, kept them or interacted with them, you know, no Westerner in for about 70 years until the Russians went down there. So in the early 90s, when these things first started becoming, early to mid-90s, when people started working with them, and they bred them, and they, you know, incubate them at the standard colubrid 82 degrees, right? You know, they do that. Man, they're hatching out all these damn males. Like, it's, you know, 2-to-1 males. And they're kind of, well, this sucks, you know? And I remember, you know, coming to the U.S., and these would be the Klaus animals. I actually have one of these animals from 98, an old female. And I had a, you know, I had a pair of them, and I still have that female. And they were $5,000 for a 2.1. You know, that was kind of the going retail price on these snakes. And, you know, every time you saw them, it'd be 2.1. I need to sell you two males for every female. Well, dude, it turns out if you incubate them at, like, 77, 78, you get, like, more females than males.
So all you do is drop down the temps. Yeah.
Right, like at least even. And usually they cook about 60 days. The funny thing is, so in 2012, I had some laid in my old place. The basement got, you know, pretty cool. It was old house, not real super, you know, super insulated. And the females for me always seem to lay late. At least most of them do. I have one that lays in May, but, you know, usually they lay in June, July, something like that. So they laid them. And I just cook them at room temperature. So I had them in there in this basement that at this point was getting into the, you know, low 70s, 60s, whatever. I had these eggs, and they hatched out after 120 days, literally double the incubation time. These snakes that were laid in June hatched at Thanksgiving. And you know what, dude? The entire clutch of them were females.
Wow.
There you go.
Yeah, huh. Like, so there's certainly something to it. Cocci are the same way. It's a little bit, the cocci is a little bit more strange because if you cook them warm, like that 82 or so, you're going to see some, you know, about half of, a third to half of them are going to come out kinked up and stuff. So I think the early ones with those, when those were at that same price point, was kind of, you know, because they were throwing away half of them because they're all kinked up and stuff.
Jesus.
But at the same time, you those high temps, you... Well, I say high. It's, you know, certainly not high by Python standards, but at that 82, you would see kinks in some of them, and you would see a lot of males. Whereas kicked down at 76, 77, you don't get kinks, and they're about half and half, males and females. So, I mean, you know, we think we know more than we do. You know, if someone says there is no temperature sex determination in snakes, I would say, we think we know
maybe.
More.
Maybe. Yeah. Awesome.
You know,
so it's
Python's
something else
probably,
to look at.
I think pythons are pretty, are proven to be pretty consistent 50-50s. But there's, you know, python, I know we think differently, right? But pythons aren't the only snakes out there.
No, no, that is true. There are others.
Heck, dude, I don't even know how you test a boa or a live bear, right? You know?
Like, I don't freaking, that would be, you
know. Like, I don't even know how you'd run that test, like, without killing the damn things themselves. You know, killing the parent stock before they drop them.
Yeah. Yeah, I have to, I'll cool down the parents to get more females. Oh, shit. So I can totally get that. But, all right, guys, we are actually going to start winding down. So I want to thank both of you for coming on and chatting it up with me while Eric, you know, vacations. He better not do this again to me, I swear to God. Anyway, why don't you guys... throw out your information, throw out, you know, Facebook pages, emails, whatever the hell you want to throw out there. Tell people where to get in touch with you and what you got going on this year. Scott?
Well, shoot, man. You can just find me at my Facebook page, Scott Board, pretty easy. And then also I got the Eliasis group, Awesome Eliasis. That's a freaking awesome page.
It is. It's nothing but
lawyers. All I got is taboos, man. But Jesus, the people are posting shit over there. It's just incredible. But and then this year, I don't know. We'll see. I got two jungle females I'm looking at right now that I'm hoping will go. Who the hell knows? you know, I'm hoping. The VPI girl's looking interesting tonight. We'll see. And Calypso, I don't know. I got to throw her back with Spark. But, yeah, it's just find me on my Facebook. I'm always around all the Carpet Python pages, too.
Awesome. And Rob?
Right on. Yeah, hopefully Eric's catching some Jamaican boats and stuff. That would be,
I asked him. He said he wasn't going to do it. So.
Well, I didn't say bring him back. I mean, we're not talking
about right.
Stuff. You know, I'm not encouraging that publicly, right? But publicly. No, I mean, yeah, hopefully. I hear they just machete him and shit. So it's, you know, same sort of thing as we talked about earlier. Like, but neither here nor there. Website, highplainsurf.com or rhinorats.com sends you to the same place. As I mentioned earlier, kind of reworking it, trying to be more like OMAC. You know, that's just the way it's going. yeah, you know, so that's in progress. Facebook is facebook.com/highplainsurf. You know, that has more pictures and stuff. That's mostly, you know, that's kind of a cool place to check out stuff that I've had before. You know, we've all got thousands of pictures of the thousands of animals we've kept. In terms of stuff for this year, hopefully rhinos, rhinos, variable kings, cocci. And that's, you know, probably an honest assessment of, you know, the sort of thing that I'll have. And, yeah, I mean, hell, dude, I'd love talking snakes with anybody. So hit me up.
Cool. Well, again, thanks, guys, for coming on, and I'll cut you loose while I close out, and we'll talk to you both soon. And, Scott, I'll see you up in Poughkeepsie in a few weeks, all right?
Yeah, see you in a couple weeks, buddy.
All right, cool. Good night, both of you.
Later.
All right, so now it's just us again. What I will say is what we got going on, you take it, Eric. Right. Anyway, so what I'll say is what's got going on with Rogue coming up. We've seen a few good things from our females this year, so definitely stay tuned to any kind of announcements towards our breeding season. Upcoming shows, I got a lot of them. So we are going to be in the Poughkeepsie, New York show. That was February 16th. And then we're going to be at the Hamburg Reptile Show. That's February 22nd. Other shows that we're going to in the area, I'm pretty sure I'm going to the Tolonia, Maryland show this weekend. There are a few other shows that I'm forgetting, and I'm going to be headed down to Tampa in March, so that's another show I'm heading off to. But anyway, thank you guys for tuning in. We will see you all next week for some more Morelia Python Radio. Good night.
what? I got a fever. And the only prescription is more cowbells.